inch and a half in diameter, and maybe he goes as much as 2 or 3 inches in diameter. When you go from steel to aluminum to copper at those diameters, because the total amount of cross-sectional material you're using is so great, the resistivity of the material is a second-order effect. But there's a catch. I ran into this problem headlong 4 years ago with a particular client. Let me drop. Where we were operating at a UHF frequency, and for mechanical reasons, we had to use stainless steel. But we needed the toughness, we needed the scratch resistance, and we were building an antenna out of stainless steel. Well, when you look at steel and the steel that you likely use for a pipe, it's pretty good stuff. Stainless steel happens to have an extremely high resistivity. It isn't that far away from nichrome. When you're building a wire-wound resistor, quite possibly you're using nichrome wire, and you've chosen nichrome because it's got a nice, stable resistance characteristic. It can tolerate some reasonably high temperatures, and it's got very high resistance. So we built an antenna out of stainless steel. The antenna itself was built out of fairly wide strips of stainless steel, and the antenna performed beautifully. That's the good news. The bad news is that we had to, for mechanical reasons on this particular project, make contact to the stainless steel wide strips of dipole antenna. We had to make contact with silver-plated point contact flexible springy little tabs. And because we were making a point contact and the actual contact area under the stainless steel, even though the contact was gold-plated, we were probably making contact of like a thousandth of an inch or smaller, small dot circle, so to speak, under the stainless steel. And the local resistance we built up in that area was a killer. If we had the option of soldering on a real solder lug onto the stainless steel, it would have worked. But for the reasons of the way this thing had to work mechanically and be disconnectable, it worked poorly. So there's a case where stainless steel gave us a problem. But it was an unusual case because we had really yucky contact. So for the usual diameters, the guy...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I have an answer to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, what you do is actually you weld to the stainless steel pipe, you weld a piece of the rod, and then this rod has the tread on it. On this tread, actually, you make a long tread, and on this tread, actually, you put something that is made of out of less resistive material, and then you actually avoiding this problem. Am I right? N2XGN.
N2MB was a question.
Barry recognized, and Wesley, you go to the head of the class. You've got the solution. Had we had the option of making some form of larger area contacting material of higher conductivity onto the end of this tab of stainless steel, it would have worked like a charm. I built a working model of that. I proved that it worked. But this particular client said, no, we have to have this method of contacting, or mechanical springy contacting with this little point contact, and under those conditions of that restriction, the project did not work well. I could not talk that particular client into changing his application. He was adamant. He didn't understand the laws of physics, and Mother Nature's laws of physics were fighting us something fierce on this one. In other words, that particular client couldn't tolerate the truth, and therefore, unfortunately, that project didn't get a chance to go forward. Barry, N2MB, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, real good. Yeah, this question, I guess, is pretty close to the subject, so that's why I brought it up. Several years ago, I was speaking to a bunch of people who operated 160 meters, and as everybody seems to know, I have a big tower in my backyard that's 95 feet tall, and I wanted to use that tower for this. So what I was planning on doing was just taking a piece of aluminum pipe, bring it out the top of that tower and bring the tower up to, 120 feet or so, which I thought would be a nice 160 meter vertical. Well, most of these guys jumped down the throes and said, cut the diameter that these guys were more involved with urban than they were fact. And what do you think of that, N2MB?
Barry, I'm listening to you on both the input frequency and the output frequency. You're dead full quieting on the input. You're a little bit noisy through the machine tonight. So maybe your 2-meter antenna is aimed in some crazy direction. You might want to correct that. I'm convinced that with the aluminum pipe coming out of the top of your windjammer-like steel tower, you would have definitely moved the resonant frequency of the tower. How well you ground the bottom of the tower and how big is the counterpoise would have been another very big variable in your particular case. And there's probably a zillion ways you could shunt feed your tower. But you could definitely move the resonant frequency of the tower with that aluminum pipe coming out of the top. I'll admit that because of the diameter of the majority of your tower, the rate at which the aluminum pipe moved the frequency would be a little bit slower than normal, but still it would move it. And now, should you resonate the tower as opposed to resonating the antenna tuner and the shunt feeding mechanism that's feeding the tower, those are some of the very many variables involved. And I'm not sure you've got enough property there on in Far Rockaway to set up a good-sized counterpoise for that. Although the good news is that you have rather salty soil, so maybe a few grounding rods into that salty soil would provide a pretty good counterpoise. That would be a fun experiment when you get around to it. And by the way, when you see, when both you and Mel see the latest issue of QEX magazine, the July-August issue 2010, there's a rather interesting article on vertical and horizontal antennas, which I'll get to in a few minutes. Back to you, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I think that kind of answers my question. In other words, you feel that these guys were just caught up in what the other guy was saying, and they sort of believed it. And I think you're right. Okay, I'm going to turn my antenna a little bit. Maybe this will help, but I'll turn it back to you. And QEX magazine, you say. I'm going to look for that one tonight. And 2MB.
Quick question. Hey, you're a lot louder now through the machine, Barry. You fixed the problem. Quick question. Go ahead. Who is that?
It's John is that now. KC2WGB. A quick question on your stainless steel antenna for your customer. Dick, wouldn't it have been possible to put a point contact area of copper where you could maintain the integrity of the stainless steel, but yet have your little contact point touching a copper piece on that stainless that was sweated on or whatever?
Hey, John, you go to the head of the class. That's the second answer we proposed. What they went and did is they went and gold-plated. They put first a nickel flashing and then a gold plating onto the stainless steel. And everyone said, hey, that's going to be beautiful. Well, they only chose, what the hell was it? Half micron, some ridiculously thin layer of gold, because somebody in the purchasing department said, gold is expensive. This eventually is going to be a production run. We want to use as little gold as possible. And they chose a thickness of gold that was so thin that was a small fraction of the skin depth at that operating frequency. And the gold made an improvement, but only an extremely minor improvement. And then we slowly convinced them by going to all the good references and showed them that, hey, the gold layer that your daggone purchasing department ordered was so extremely thin and therefore essentially ineffective that you guys are nickel and diming this project and you're killing it. And by that time, they said, well, we've run out of time. We haven't got time to go back and use the thicker gold plating. It was a real frustrating project, as you can tell. Back to you, John. KC2WDG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I didn't want to interrupt Mel too much. That answered my question. The customer obviously wasn't looking for a response. Maybe it was a money issue.
I have another comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Wesley.
Well, I remember the long time ago, when I was in Poland, I had a problem with connecting the pipe that was made from the stainless steel, and that was in the antenna circuit. What actually, one of the guys that I was working with, he told me, listen, Wesley, you make the cylinder from the copper, and not a cylinder that you put inside that tube, and you actually screwed it. So, yes, I did, and it works perfectly. Back to you, and to Jim.
Yeah, I'm guessing what you did is you chose the stainless steel to be a weather impervious material, but nice and strong. That was the center tubing. The outer tubing was the copper, which gave you high conductivity, and now you get the best of both worlds. You got the conductivity of the copper, you got the strength of the steel, and when you recognize the fact that a radio frequency circuit only flows through the outer fraction of a thousandth of an inch of your conducting materials, that's the so-called skin effect. RF energy only flows through the nearest thousandth of an inch or so of the outer conductor of the material. And if what is underneath is steel or wood or balsa or whatever, doesn't matter. The RF never goes there. This breaks down a little bit when it comes to household wiring, and you start using very, very thick household wiring, because the skin depth phenomena is a function of 1 over square root of frequency. When you get down to extremely low frequencies, like 60 hertz, and when you go down to very large diameter pieces of copper, triple aught and beyond, all of a sudden the 60 hertz skin depth starts affecting you. And so when you're using very large diameter copper conductors for conducting thousands of amperes of your power circuit, you know, your distribution power circuit, in some cases you're going to save money and save weight by going to tubing even at 60 hertz. Because even at 60 hertz, the 60 hertz sine wave only goes a certain depth in the copper. But there it's a much bigger depth because the frequency is much lower. But you guys would get a kick out of that one. Someone else wants to make a comment? Give me a call, letter, and name right now.
Casey. I have just two more things to say.
Wesley recognized, and was there another person? Thought I was hearing a couple of break-ins. Go ahead, Wesley.
What we use is, I don't know where to get it in the United States. We had a conductive paste. So we put inside the thread, we put the conductive paste, but outside that, to prevent that the copper to even change the color, we use the mechanical gas grease, which was called Tabot at that time. It was the from the car when you don't want something to get rusted. It's very tough. It's like a butter. Back to you.
Yeah, when it comes to good electrical contacts within a house, particularly when you're mixing aluminum wiring and copper wiring, they make special greases that help the galvanic action between the two so that the contact is maintained. And when it comes to a copper conductor that's being used as an antenna at any reasonable frequencies, from 1,000 megacycles and lower, the copper oxide that you build up on the outside of copper that's exposed to weather looks homely to your eye. But when you study what that really is it's a 1/10,000th or 1/100,000th. It's an extremely thin layer of copper oxide. Very similar to what happens when you put up an 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge household wire, and you ask the question, should I remove the rubber insulation or the plastic insulation? The real answer for most circumstances, it doesn't matter. The RF energy goes down through the outer plastic or rubber insulation and ignores it. It waits until it sees the copper underneath and starts doing what it's supposed to do. By the same token, the copper oxide is a fairly resistive material, very, very thin on the outside of the copper. Radio-wise, at most of the frequencies we're talking about, the difference would be extremely difficult to measure with laboratory test equipment. I'll admit that if you were building a 10,000 megacycle cavity out of copper, let me drop, the thin layer of copper oxide in that case would make a slight difference in the Q of the cavity. And maybe you'd like it to be silver-plated. And that makes some difference, but nowhere near as much as you think. So worrying about putting materials on the copper antenna to make it look pretty, go ahead and do that for aesthetic reasons, for beauty reasons. radio-wise, most of the time it is not required, in my opinion. Okay, we probably got a little bit off subject here, Mel, but maybe we came up with a couple of other interesting situations. And Mel, when you see the July-August 2010 QEX, I thought of you immediately. There's a beautiful article in there about how to measure the quality of crystal resonators that are about to go into a filter. And second of all, there's a beautiful article about how to build a sleeve dipole with a perfect balance for it, which I'll discuss a little bit later. K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, fine business. All right, let's just do a summarize this and say that if you're building this vertical and you use 3/4 inch, 1 inch, inch and a quarter, aluminum conduit or copper pipe or any of that, that not to worry, it is not going to in any way really factor into the performance of the antenna on HF, correct? Can we say that as a bottom line so that they will not feel that they have to go chasing after some exotic materials, Dick, over?
I agree with you, Mel. It is a second order or third order effect. You're going to choose the materials you build your vertical radiator. For mechanical reasons, for cost reasons, for wind loading reasons, for reasons of ability to attach hardware to it and whatever, there's a whole bunch of other reasons than electronics. So that vertical radiator, its diameter and its type of material, under most circumstances, almost doesn't matter radio-wise. That's the impression I have from the Brown and Woodward curves, from your and my experience, from the articles that we read. I think that is not a major determining factor. K2KEY, K2RIW.
The bottom line is, build the vertical, and don't worry that somebody comes along and says, well, yeah, I should have bought a fancy piece of that shiny aluminum that costs so many dollars a foot, that is dull-looking stuff that you use, common, that you find in many of the home supply places. It will not have much of an effect if you polish it or whatever, or you leave it as it is with it, or it gets some kind of a patina on it, that it is not factoring in effect to any great extent. Okay, so we'll leave it at that. Now, here's another one that's come up. And this one has repeated itself a number of times, and I don't know if we've ever commented on. They sell rotary dipoles. I guess you've seen them advertised, that they have rotary dipoles. Some of them are multi-band jobs and all. And a number of people have said, well, according to what you have told us about dipoles, about more or less that the optimum performance is going to be broadside to it, we find that we rotate the dipole, not really a great effect. In other words, they're looking for a real pronounced effect, more or less what you would see on some kind of Yagi. What should they expect from a rotary dipole, Dick, as far as difference in changing its azimuth, over?
Okay, that was beautifully covered in one of the technical topics of QST Magazine. I'm looking it up right now. It was the very last issue, I believe. The February issue. Oh, wait, I got the wrong one in my hand. I thought I picked up the right one. Okay, let me pick up the other one that I've got here. Hope it's the right one. Yeah, now that's the April issue. I don't know where the heck I put the right issue. But the last issue of QST Magazine, there was an article showing you what happens of a horizontally polarized dipole at various altitudes above the ground. Let me drop and explain what's going on here. If I put a pure horizontally polarized dipole at an extremely high altitude, and now I measure the radiation pattern as I rotate it, let's assume now that I'm building the dipole, and at this instant of time, the dipole is facing east-west, and I want to talk to somebody to the east. Off the end of the dipole, there is a very deep null. That's real. Now let's go back to a realistic situation where the dipole is not a zillion wavelengths in the air. I've got a dipole that's a half wavelength above the ground in my backyard. It's a 40-meter dipole, and I've got it mounted 35 feet in the air. Is that half wave or is that quarter wave? Let me think about that. I think that's half wave. So I got it 35 feet in the air. This 40-meter, or maybe it's a 20-meter dipole. Because of the altitude of the dipole above the ground, because the ground is a reflecting mirror-like surface, that means there's a real dipole 30 feet in the air, the one I'm constructing. There is a mirror image of that dipole 30 feet below the ground because of the reflection off the ground. And those two dipoles are out of phase with each other. The bottom line of that is that if I plot the vertical radiation pattern, most of the signal is coming off that dipole 45 degrees above the horizon in all directions. Now, that's because of ground reflection. Now when I look at that null that exists at the end of the dipole, I've got a dipole aimed east-west. Let me drop. And I'm now talking to somebody that's due east of me. Maybe it's a guy in Africa. My great circle path from Long Island due east, I think, falls somewhere in Africa. And I'm talking to a guy in Africa. And I rotate the dipole, so it's east-west. I expect to null him out. But because the major elevation pattern coming off the dipole is at a 45-degree elevation, the main signal coming off the dipole with real ground reflection isn't coming directly off the end of the dipole where there is a null. The major radiation pattern is coming 45 degrees above the horizon. Therefore, you think you're looking at the null, the end of the dipole. You're looking at the dipole 45 degrees away from its end, from its collinear position, and therefore there is no longer a null there. Therefore, that particular dipole, as you rotate it, you expect to see a big signal broadside. You expect to see no signal end fire. You think the signal is going to go down by 40 dB, and it goes down by 3 dB or something like that because of this elevation problem. And as I said, there's a beautiful article in the latest issue of QST Magazine that shows you diagrams of this. That's the article that also shows you what a circular polarized wave looks like. And I wrote them a letter saying, you got it backwards, fellas. You use good common sense about the circular polarized wave. And you called it clockwise, and it's counterclockwise. But that's another issue. But that's a particular article in the latest issue, and it'll partially explain this phenomenon that I think they're running into, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Yes, this is what generates this kind of controversy, because that is why they got really confused. If you look at the July issue of QST, and they show you those nice patterns, which, of course, you also can find in the antenna handbook, you would assume that you will see, you know, a vast difference if you go ahead and rotate that dipole. And the ones that, for instance, I use it as an example for 20 meters, that you're saying, in other words, Dick, the best you can expect, let's say, even at, what has he got, elevation, an elevation. At elevation, azimuth zero gain. No, I'm just looking here. Let's see, at elevation pattern, 24 degrees, at elevation of 24 degrees. You would say that pattern, if that pattern existed, that the best you're going to see is with rotating the dipole is maybe 3 dB at best. Is that correct? Over.
The exact number of dB, I'm not sure, Mel. You're going to have to study that diagram a little bit more closely. I've got all my issues of QST Magazine here except the June issue. Or correction, except the July issue. June or July, but I think it was the July issue that had that beautiful diagram that I'm protesting about. And what in the world did I do with that issue? I probably considered it so valuable I put it in a safe place. But yes, it's nowhere near the number of dB of null off the end that you expect. Therefore, a realistic guy is going to say one of two things. One, do I really want to go through all the rigmarole of building a rotatable dipole? In the case of a 40-meter dipole, that's a lot of mechanical strength required to be able to rotate this thing that is 67 feet tip to tip if I build a full-size one without loading coils. Should I go through the effort of doing that? And if he goes one step further instead of building a complete half-wave, purely horizontal dipole, if he builds an inverted V, he doesn't have to rotate it. It only requires one vertical support high-altitude thing at the center. The ends are come out to egg insulators that go to ropes that come all the way down to the ground, and you tie it to a tree or you tie it to a fence or whatever. Once you build a inverted V, the amount of energy coming off the ends is even greater. I'll admit that when you look at it broadside, you're going to see purely horizontal polarization. You look at it end fire, you're going to be seeing purely vertical polarization, but that doesn't matter. The real pattern of that antenna for the propagation you're going to be doing is almost omnidirectional. You think it's a horizontally polarized inverted V dipole, but it radiates in all directions. No rotation required, nice and simple. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, you just jumped to part B of the question, because buying one of these rotatable dipoles is a costly affair. They are producing a number of them, and maybe not as much as buying a full-size, you know, full Yagi or tri-Yagi, but they sell you, in many cases, just a single element. And then, of course, you got to go buy yourself a rotator. And that's what came up in question B. Is, in other words, in your words, does not pay to invest this kind of money because the payback for all this work and all this expenditure is not going to be, you're not going to say, oh, wow, this really was the, you know, putting this effort in really paid off. In other words, as you said, making the inverted V out of wire with one support will most likely act basically the same way at a fraction of the cost. Am I quoting correct, Dick? Over.
Absolutely, Mel. You and I are about to save them quite a bit of money. All the rigmarole of buying that expensive piece of rotary dipole hardware with that great big rotator to do it is of limited benefit. The cost-to-benefit ratio here is fairly high. The bang for the dollar is fairly low, is another way of putting it. The main thing that will happen with that rotary dipole at a reasonable altitude, and this is a very subtle thing, is that if you're talking to somebody that's due east of you, Great Circle Path due east is probably Central Africa. So you're talking to your buddy in Africa, and you rotate the dipole broadside, so it's north-south. You're emitting a primarily horizontally polarized wave. After it goes through the ionosphere with the Faraday rotation, the ionosphere is a plasma with a magnetic field, and that signal rotates a few times in polarization and ends up in Africa, and who knows if it ends up at vertical, slant 45, or horizontal. It ends up at some particular polarization and gives a certain response to the guy in Africa. When you take your horizontal dipole that used to be north-south, and now you rotate it so it's east-west, and because of the takeoff angle, it's not giving you a null, it's giving you a dB or two down, maybe 3 dB down in response in amplitude, but the polarization changes. When you look at a dipole with reflection off the ground, broadside, you are emitting pure horizontal. I'm not sure what's going to arrive, but you're emitting pure horizontal. When you make the dipole end fire to him, if he's east of you and you operate, let me drop, and you rotate the dipole so it's east-west, what comes off at the elevation angle because of ground reflection will be an emitted vertically polarized signal. Ain't that crazy? You've got a pure horizontal dipole. You can measure it any way you want with your ruler and your protractor and your surveying equipment and whatever. It is a pure horizontal dipole. You've rotated it so it's east-west, but the signal that comes off of it with ground reflection, the elevation angle of roughly a 25, 35, 45 degree elevation angle, is primarily vertically polarized. So therefore, as you rotate the dipole, you're going from horizontal reception to vertical polarization reception, depending on the state of the atmosphere, the ionosphere, today, and whether or not the gray line is between you and whatever, and how the ionosphere is rotating, some days you're going to see a great big null in the performance because you're now cross-polarized to your vertically polarized reception off the end of this horizontal dipole. So it's primarily a polarization rotator, even though you think it's a pattern rotator. Ain't that crazy? K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yes, I understand. The hottest thing is to convince people, how could that shiny piece of pipe that's up there not outperform that piece of wire that I found in the scrap pile and made an antenna out of it, and how can that be that, you know, that the performance should be definitely outstanding, that shiny piece of metal compared to that piece of wire, but I guess we'll go through this over and over and over again. As you said, you can listen to this debate on the air many a times, and it's very hard to convince people as to, like you say, what exactly is taking place. So, all right, you want to take a standby, see if we didn't. Did we miss any questions at all? Because I don't want to get some emails again that, what's wrong with you guys? Don't you give anybody a break? And, let's just take a standby. See, did we miss anyone, Dick? Over.
Yeah, what's
to me, it's Roy. I have a question on your subject that you're talking about.
Okay, Joe recognized, and I'm not sure, did Rich N2EO also sign in? Maybe he didn't, and maybe it's just my memory. Rich, are you there? I think
yes, I did, Dick.
You did sign in with a question, okay? Since Joe has got a question on the subject, we're going to go over to Joe. To me, to RYY. We're going to wait for you. You sound good. K2RYW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. If the signal is horizontally polarized coming out of the dipole, broadside to the dipole, and it tends to be more vertical or completely vertical at the ends of the dipole, what happens when you go 45 degrees broadside? What does the polarization do? And which way would you think it goes? Does it follow like a linear progression as far as the polarization being 45 between vertical and horizontal?
Here I'm not positive, Joe. There's going to be a little bit of elliptical polarization effect when you're at 45 degrees away from broadside and infire. But I think the primary component is going to be a slow rotation of polarization. Broadside, you are emitting pure horizontal polarization. Of the primary signal that comes off with ground reflection on infire, it is 90-some-odd% vertically polarized, I believe. But when you're rotating the antenna to be halfway between those two extremes, I think the primary signal is going to be slant 45-degree polarized. So it is a primarily polarized rotator as you rotate this horizontal dipole. Because you get a little bit of phase shift off of that ground reflection, there's going to be a slight circular polarization characteristic to it, elliptical polarization. But I think that's a secondary effect. It would be fun to experiment with, though making the right kind of instrumentation to tell you what is the instantaneous polarimetry of what you're emitting, that's getting a little bit deep for the average guy. Over to you, Joe, W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Have you ever tried to measure something like that yourself? Because you're above the average guy.
Thank you for the compliment, but I am primarily a VHF, UHF, SHF operator. The total number of hours in the last 30 years that I have spent on HF reception or transmission, I can probably count it on one hand. So I've done very little HF operating here, Joe. I'm primarily a higher frequency guy. And that's just me. That's where my interest lies. Except for the 2-meter operation by way of this TechNet and the 27 years that it has existed, 27 and a half years. And this is TechNet number 1305 of the series that began in September of 1982. except for this 2 meter operation. I do even very little 2 meters. 2 meters to me is my first IF on my 10 gig equipment. But my 10 gig equipment needs repair. It's been down off the tower for a while. So, the majority of my operation these days is on 2 meters. Craziness. But I got great capability, Joe. I'm looking forward to getting back on the high frequencies, and I'm making some really big plans. And if you're a member of the microwave reflector, the WA1MBA, I've been answering a bunch of... Let me drop. Lately, I've been answering a bunch of questions for guys who are setting up 500-watt traveling wave tube amplifiers on 10 gigahertz. It turns out that all of a sudden on the surplus market, a number of ground station traveling wave tube amplifiers in the 300 and 500 watt class have suddenly become available to amateurs, serious microwave amateurs worldwide, to take a 14 to 14.5 gig traveling wave tube and move it down to 10 gigahertz. Very easy to do if you know what you're doing. That's the good news. The bad news is that most of these high-power tubes have a waveguide output assembly, which is peaked at 14 to 14.5 gigs, the normal uplink frequency, and because there is an extremely fancy tuning network within that piece of waveguide, which is controlling the group delay distortion, the phase characteristics of that uplink signal for a satellite to control its fidelity. That very fancy network becomes a complete filter nulling out 10 gigahertz. So the tube has got all kinds of power capability, more power than you know what to do with, more gain than you know what to do with at 10 gigs. The traveling wave tube has got it. But the DON output waveguide assembly is stopping the signal from getting out of the tube. And you'd be amazed how many people have burned up a tube not knowing that there's a great big short circuit at the output connector. All that power, 500 watts of it, is reflected back into the tube and burns up the helix. And they thought there's all kinds of mysterious oscillations and whatever. So I've been giving these guys all kinds of benefits of my wisdom on that because I own one of those tubes. I've made those measurements. I haven't yet modified that waveguide assembly. And so these guys got to make sure they don't give up. They got a very valuable piece of hardware in their hands. And once they realize what's the gate between them and some nice high power output, all of a sudden there's going to be some good operating.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Have you ever powered that tube up, Dick?
Absolutely. On about 5 occasions, I saw the fact that it's got a perfect null at 10 gigs. What I'm telling these guys to do, to confirm it, is to feed the tube backwards. Turn the tube off. Feed with a directional coupler so you can make visual measurements. Feed the output waveguide assembly backwards. The traveling wave tube helix circuit is a beautiful TEM-like 50-ohm structure. It's a 50-ohm transmission line. On the input RF connector, where the SMA connector is, and you normally pour the power into the tube, put a beautiful 50-ohm termination. Therefore, the helix is a perfect 50-ohm dummy load to your output piece of waveguide. Feed the signal backwards with the tube turned off and sweep its standing wave ratio. By the law of reciprocity, that waveguide assembly is like an antenna. If you can modify that probe assembly in there so it gives you a good visual at 10 gigs fed backwards, by definition, it'll give you good visual when fed forward. You'd be amazed how many people said, wow, why didn't I think of that? KE2EJ, K2RIW and TechNet. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, did you build a power supply or somebody gave you one?
So MUF with a question. MUF, you're on the list. There's a yes and a no to that, Eric. I own one high power tube that comes with power supply. That's the good news. In fact, I own two of them. One of them needs three-phase power, and that's very difficult for me to build balanced three-phase power in a private home. One of them does run directly off the 220-volt line. One of my tubes needs a power supply. So the tube that's got the highest power, the easiest to convert, is the one that I don't have a power supply for, and so on. So, in other words, are you about to offer me a power supply, in which case I'll cross your palm with a whole lot of silver? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I actually might be able to do that, but my concern is, Have you ever, the tubes that I gave you, did you ever hook it up to an ion pump supply?
The tubes that you gave me, ion pump supply. Whoa. How many years ago, and are you sure that I was the recipient? I'm a little bit forgetful, anything beyond a year. So run that by again, Eric, go ahead.
No, I don't know if you're aware, but the version of the tubes that I gave you requires that you hook it up to an ion pump, or, you know, some 4,000 volt supply every now and then, so it doesn't gas up on you.
And I would be sure to do that, both the wake-up procedure and the ion pump, before I would power up such a tube. I've got to get back to just making my receiver equipment on 10 gig work. See, I have talked to people on single sideband on 10 gigahertz in 10 separate states, most of them New England, but some of them out to Pennsylvania and Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, and so on, all the way down to Virginia. Talked to a guy in Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, on 10 gigs. My best DX was 380 miles. All of that was done at 0.2 watt, solid state, into a 2-foot dish at the top of 100 feet of tower. And if I could, in the old days, anybody that got close to a watt of power output at 10 gigs was considered high power. Well, because of the equipment that's becoming available, these guys are now starting to get into hundreds of watts, tens of watts, and hundreds of watts. You're going to hear some brand new distance records. In fact, 2 days ago, somebody just broke the distance record on 10 gigs, something like 2,400 kilometers, by going from an island off the coast of Africa all the way over to Portugal. 2,400 kilometers on 10 gigs was just the gap that was bridged. So you think that that frequency is only good for line of sight? Oh boy, over water paths, it's got all kinds of capabilities you wouldn't believe. Mr. MUF, I think it was, give me your full call letters and your name, and go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the net. This is K2MUF. Name is Joe, and we're out in Ridge, Long Island. Back in the 60s, we were working at Polarad, P-O-L-A-R-A-D, not Polaroid, Polarad Electronics over in Long Island City. We were developing traveling wave tubes. Do the modern ones now still have a solenoid? Are they still housed in a solenoid?
A good question, no. And the, Joe, and the answer is absolutely no. 90-some-odd percent of all the tubes that you can get your hands on today are called PPM tubes, periodic permanent magnet type tubes. You got a whole lot of donut-shaped magnets, one every quarter inch or 3/8 inch, and a zillion of them along the length of the tube. That does all the focusing. The solenoid type focusing traveling wave tube is a lot simpler to run and align, but it's a big magnetic assembly with a fancy power supply to power that solenoid magnet. And so for a whole bunch of reasons, these PPM tubes are now just about the standard for the last 20 years or so. And when you worked for Polarad, a good buddy of mine who went from Polarad to Airborne Instruments Laboratory was a guy named Richard Hutter. I wonder if you ran into a guy named Richard Hutter when you were there, Joe. I think it's Kilo 2, Mike, Uniform, Foxtrot, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, the name does sound familiar. Yeah, and the biggest problems we had, we were trying to run some up at 100 gigahertz, and we were having problems with jitter and stuff. Yeah, the biggest thing we had were the power supplies to power the solenoids. We had to use saturable reactors for the power supplies. They really needed extremely filtered and regulated voltage. Otherwise, you're going to screw up the tube. Okay, very good. I thank you very much. I figured there must be something modern now because those solenoids were a pain in the neck. Back to the net. We'll be listening. Thank you.
Very fine, Joe. These periodic permanent magnet tubes, sub-kilowatt, they work extremely well. There's kind of a sound barrier to get beyond kilowatt level with a periodic permanent magnet tube. And many of these tubes have got good capability to numbers, up to numbers like 20 gigahertz. You said 100 gigahertz, and that is very difficult. The way a traveling wave tube works, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, the helix that's surrounding the electronic beam must get smaller and smaller in diameter. That means that you must have higher and higher fidelity of the focusing of an extremely narrow beam that goes down that helix. You're making the helix smaller in diameter, so you've got less than a wavelength per turn, so that it gives you the gain capability. Also, you want to have that wave between the helix and the electronic beam to couple to each other to give you the gain. So a bunch of reasons the helix gets smaller in diameter. Therefore, the degree of difficulty of building a traveling wave tube at higher frequencies approximately goes up square law with frequency. To build a tube that works real well at 40 gigs is four times more difficult than to build a tube that works real well at 20 gigs. So you guys were seeking 100 gigs. Wow. You were pushing the envelope there, Joe, as I see it. I know we're getting pretty far off subject here, Mel. K2KEY. Look where we got on this one. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, we have N2EO, our good buddy Rich. He's been on the list. He has a question, please. Shall we take him now? Because it's not fair that we keep putting him off. Over.
You're right. He's recently come home from an operation. He's got to get his beauty sleep. We don't want to keep him up too late. Go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, TechNet, Limelock, N2EO. Actually, I've been up late. I feel 15 years younger. So, it's a good thing. Dick, I've been working on this Collins 62S1. I got a lot of it straightened out. The only thing is that when I'm running into a situation here where I'm getting more power out on 2 meters than I am on 6 meters. Should be the reverse, you know, because the efficiency goes down when you go up in frequency. I'm getting almost 80 watts out on 2 and only about 65 watts out on 6. And I've got more grid drive on 6 than I do on 2. So, by the way, don't feel that you were putting me off because I've been working on this during the net. What I've been doing was flexing and adjusting the link coupling and flexing and adjusting the Pi network coil, and I've really gotten just about nowhere. I'm pulling about 220 milliamps on a point current on... and about 250 milliamps on 2 meters. Any thoughts, Dick? K2RIW. By the way, I wonder if you and Mel, I sent you some pictures of some stuff that I restored. I don't know if you saw them. Technet Limelock and 2EO.
Two quick questions, Rich. Number one, when did you send the pictures? I haven't looked at my email in 2 days, so maybe that's why I haven't seen them. And second of all, the actual tube you're using, is it a 4X150 or a 4X250B tube? Over to you, Rich.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Well, first of all, Dick, I sent the pictures this morning to you and Mel, and I'm using a 4X2, I have a 4CX250B. Is there a difference between the 250B and the 4X150? Because I do have a brand new 4X150 that I can pop in.
Okay, I got some good news for you. I'm glad you're here. Glad to hear that you're using the 4CX250B. The 4X150, because it has a glass envelope, it has the exact same plate dissipation, 250 watts, when you move enough air through it. The glass itself starts becoming lossy as you go up in frequency. That's the reason why the tube has full power output capability up to 150 megahertz and not beyond. You try running a 4CX150A at, say, 432 megacycles, full bore, and the dissipation of the glass will overheat it, melt it, and the tube will get a suck in, and it will lose its vacuum. The 4CX250B has full power output capability up to 500 megacycles. So the ceramic tube, the 4CX250, a superior tube. If you're comparing the power output capability of that tube on 80 meters, 6 meters, or 2 meters. That tube doesn't know the difference. The tube doesn't start rolling off until you get to 500 megs. So at every one of the frequencies you're talking about, a tube has the exact same power output capability. A tube, it doesn't see the frequency until you start getting above 400 megs, let's say. So the difference in power output you're getting, let me drop, between 6 meters and 2 meters is not the tube. There's something about your circuit that's doing it. The fact that the tube draws more current on 2 meters, 250 milliamps versus 220 milliamps on 6, that's a strong clue. The amount of current the tube draws is a function of how heavy it is loaded, what is the screen voltage, what is the plate voltage, and how heavy you're driving it. Since this is Class A service that you're talking about, linear service, it sounds to me like there's something about your circuit that's not biasing it as high on 6 meters for whatever reason, or it's not loading it properly. By way of the standby bias current measurement, by way of the screen grid voltage measurement, that'll tell you whether or not you're putting the same voltages on the tube. And when you actually come to reading power output from the tube, assuming your power output meter is telling you the truth, some power output meters read high on 2 meters and don't read as high on 6 meters. You got to worry about that a little bit. So assuming your power output, let me drop. Assuming your power output device is telling you the truth, the next thing to look at when you're looking at full power output on 6 and full power output on 2 is what is the screen grid current looking like. If the screen grid current is more negative on, let's say, for instance, 2 meters, it tells you that the current, that the loading of the plate circuit is heavier on 2 meters. That would explain more power output. Or correspondingly, if on 6 meters, the screen grid current is more positive, that tells you the screen grid more negative is heavy loading, more positive is lightly loaded. So the resonating and loading of your plate tank circuit on 6 versus 2 is what we're talking about. However, 65 watts versus 80 watts, I think are the numbers you're telling me about, decibel-wise, it's only a dB or so of difference. The guys you're talking to would never see the difference. You're into the academics here. But there's enough of a scientist in Mr. Tashner that he wants to know what's going on. So measuring voltages, measuring currents, eventually is going to give you a clue. And also, just to be double darn sure, borrow from Barry some method of measuring power output to be sure that your power output meter is not fibbing to you. But the fact that you're drawing more current in one than the other is a clue as I see it there, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, N2EO. Well, the equipment here is accurate. I'm using a Berg 43 with the proper element on 2 and the proper element on 6, and I'm going into a flat dummy load. I have a WaveTech 3000B service monitor, which has a built-in dummy load good for 100 watts. That's flat to a gig. So I believe my measurements are accurate. They're using Pi network. It's not really a Pi network, but they're using some form of link coupling. And what I've always seen is that you don't always couple the link tight. You know, the link may be partially meshed, however you put it, with coil, until you get maximum power transfer. What Collins did was they have it maximum coupled. In other words, the link is totally around the coil. Does that make sense to you, Dick?
Yes, it does, Rich. Are you telling me you do not have a loading control, a control that you can twist that changes the amount of plate resonator loading by way of the antenna? If you don't, then the good news is they forced you into a particular fixed amount of loading on the assumption that your antenna is a pure 50-ohm load. But I'd like to believe there's some kind of loading control beyond just the tuning control for the plate circuit. Back to you, Rich.
Well, they do have a loading control, Dick. What they did, as far as I could see, they put a capacitor, the loading capacitor, going to ground in series with the link.
Yep, there's a problem with that. And that is when that capacitor in series with the link loading coil hits resonance with that link, that's the maximum loading you can get. And even though you can move the capacitor to a higher number of picofarads, more meshing of that air variable capacitor, common sense would lead you to believe you're going to get heavier loading. Not necessarily. You're now taking the link out of resonance. Therefore, it doesn't give you as heavier loading. So if you take a look at the April and May issue of QST, way back in the dark ages of 1972, the so-called parallel kilowatt strip line amplifier, I got a diagram there showing you what happens with link coupling, the way it can fool you. And there's a diagram showing you loading versus link coupling capacitor. And that's the reason why I like flapper tuning capacitors, series tuning capacitor, as opposed to link coupling. Everyone thinks link coupling is required in order to get rid of the higher harmonics. On paper, it sounds right. In reality, the difference is extremely minor, and link coupling circuits are a little bit more difficult to set up properly. So I'm beginning to think that on 6 meters, you're not getting heavier enough loading. And there's ways you can increase the loading by changing the size of the loading coil and the position of the loading coil and so on. So as you twist that loading control, that series capacitor with the link coupling, and as you monitor screen grid current, you got to be careful now. I was about to say you're going to see that it goes to a certain amount of screen grid negative, moving in the negative direction, meaning heavier loading. Let me drop. You twist that control, you're going to see the screen grid current going toward negative, indicating heavier loading. You're going to see it bottom out, so to speak, in the middle of the tuning of that loading control. That's what I said you're going to see if it was the dominant resonator in the circuit. Unfortunately, as you adjust that to being under resonance and over resonance, so to speak, with that loading capacitor, you're simultaneously tuning the primary coil in and out of resonance, so it's going to give you a confusion. So if you go to what you think is the heaviest loading and you rock the tuning control back and forth for best power output, then you go a little bit higher in loading capacitor setting and rock the tuning control, and a little bit lower in the loading control setting and rock the tuning control. As long as you understand the readings you're about to get, I think you're about to discover that there is a certain spot in the loading control in the middle of its range which gives you maximum loading, and that maximum loading on 2 meters, on 6 meters, is not as high as it is on 2 meters. I think you're eventually going to find that out, in which case you can decide to make a change in the loading network if you want to, in order to increase the loading to get higher power output on 6 meters. That's what I think is going on, and that's the problem with a link coupling. It can give you this crazy characteristic that's not common sense. Wonder if I made some sense, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yes it does. Alright, in other words, once I hit resonance, I see what you're saying, once I hit resonance, it doesn't matter how much I change the coupling, it's just going to move the capacitor to a different spot and to achieve the same resonance. I see what you're saying. What is the effect of compressing and stretching the plate tuning coil? What's that going to do? I tried that, and what happened, well, what I did see was the plate tuning would dip in a different spot.